Nope, that's
really
not
nice
it.
To meet you.
Senator Bruce Carlisle, we've met before.
Yeah, it's good to see you again.
In my past iteration.
So I think, guys, because of because of sort of the local interest and the sort of dynamic nature of
Never Dan Wolf, I have the pleasure of being
I feel like doing some karaoke.
If everyone would take their seats, please. I'd like to introduce our next panel. It's called Offshore Wind Done Right. And the facilitator, everyone knows, is former Senator Dan Wolf, who's also CEO of Cape Air.
Hello, 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 everybody. I'm going to wait for people to take a seat, so just stand by. While we're doing that, we were sort of talking. Can everybody hear me? Is this mic on?
Yes.
You can probably hear me without the mic, right? I've got a very obnoxious voice. We were discussing up here, a little bit of this is know your audience. So just out of curiosity, how many folks here are familiar with the Vineyard Wind projects? I'm not going to ask for anything negative, but I'm just, from what you all know, how many people here are in support of the project as you understand it? So it's not unanimous, but it looks really close, because one of the things I'd like this panel to be about and focused on is not just sort of why we need to do this, because I think we're with a group here, a lot of whom have done their homework and understand that. So a little bit more about the history, where we are today, and then really engage some of the folks here who are policymakers, or at least involved with policymakers, to what we all can do to make sure this thing gets picked up, doesn't get dropped, and moved across the finish line. So that's what I would like to do. As people speak, I'd like for them to introduce themselves. Like Heather said when I was on a panel, I'm not crazy about reading bios. So as we do it, what I'd love for people to do is introduce themselves. I'd like to start, because even though we're talking about an industry, we're talking about offshore wind, and we all understand that we are in probably one of the best locations in North America to actually utilize, extract that resource in a really positive way. A lot of this discussion is around Vineyard Wind, because that and the other project taking place in the waters south of Martha's Vineyard that the Bureau of Offshore Energy Management has run a process on, that really is in our backyard, and I think Vineyard Wind is the furthest along in that process. So, Nate, could you introduce yourself and then maybe talk a little bit about the history and where the project is today, and then the look ahead?
Sure. Can you hear me, everyone? Yeah. All right, great. Nate Mayo, I'm the Manager of Development and Policy for Vineyard Wind. Provincetown native, and admittedly the island folks weren't able to make it over for clear reasons, and this is one of the rare moments where there's a Cape and Islands event and I don't play second fiddle to their harrowing adventures to get here, so I think I'm probably the furthest afield of any Cape Codder. Been working on the project for the last couple of years during a really exciting time. There's others on the panel here who have a perspective as well as sort of where the landscape of offshore wind came and where it's where we are now. It's big stuff, and what's happening on the Cape in all of these venues is big stuff. Offshore wind is perhaps the biggest, but it does get pretty simple when you look at the fundamentals. We're talking about 84 pilings, about 15 to 20 miles south of the islands, connected to the mainland, that are separated by about a mile apiece, and that will generate enough electricity to power the Cape and Islands twice over. It's as simple as that. Now, when we get into the regulatory matrix, the politics, the finance, the engineering, of course, it gets more complicated. But that's the essence of this project, and it builds on decades of European experience, as we've all heard, and hopefully soon we'll see in our waters. So I think that we've had a really great sort of a crescendo and evolution over the day in terms of what we've been talking about. We had Senator Scheer and Representative Fernandez here. We had Senator Ed Markey, who's been a huge champion for this project and many other renewables issues in Washington. In the end, we have to get to actual projects. We have to get to actual things that we're doing. The policies are the backbone, but we have to have that outcome and that result. It's a mini split. It's an EV. It's a new clean source of energy generated locally. So this process is sort of is towards the tail end, and we've heard about some sort of recent hiccups and setbacks in Washington. But it is important to look back, not just in the last year or two of Vineyard Wind, or even in the last several years of Massachusetts, or even in the last over a decade in terms of federal policy. We've had a lot of success. It's not been fast enough, and we haven't gotten to that final end result just yet. But there's been a lot of good news as this industry is burgeoning in our region. It also is important. I know we're all climate advocates in this room, and we all push that issue, and that's what drives us. There are economic fundamentals in this new world that transcend even that in our political discourse. So in Massachusetts, it's become a nonpartisan issue. 83C, which we'll hear perhaps a little more about from others, has set the stage, and it was supported in a near unanimous fashion, bipartisan. So I'd like to get more into the dialogue and let others speak. But what I want to suggest to people is there are big things that are happening, and Cape Cod is poised to really be that model. Like, they were showing pictures of SAMHSA last year. The Cape has an opportunity, and it's in every one of your towns and neighborhoods, and it's embracing the little things and the big things and being dedicated to them. Vineyard Wind's a part of that. We were the epicenter of offshore wind opposition for a long time, so it's certainly befitting. Our coastline's falling into the ocean. Our economy depends on a stable climate, and we're going to be facing a lot of trouble there. So I could go on and on, but I hope there's a meaningful discourse here that some of the other members can contribute to.
Great. Thank you, Nate. And I'd like to go to Bruce Carlisle to talk a little bit about the state's role and perspective. Bruce is the Senior Director of Offshore Wind for Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, leads the effort to advance the successful and responsible development of offshore wind. And got to know Bruce a little bit when I was in the Senate, and really appreciate the great work he and the Center are doing. So, Bruce, you want to?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. And thank you all for having us here. What a great program. Thanks to the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative and the sponsors of this event. I know you guys are going to be taking the really fruitful discussions from today's panels and working them into local agendas. It was really sort of a common theme that I heard from this morning and this afternoon. So thanks to all of you, really. So the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center is a quasi-state agency. Like the Connecticut Green Bank, we are funded by a very small tariff on a non-renewable electric generation. We use those resources to turn back around and accelerate the growth of the clean energy sector in Massachusetts and beyond. So we focus on increasing adoption, driving down costs, expanding the Massachusetts economy and our jobs, and realizing the climate and environmental benefits that come with that. MassAEC produces every year a clean energy industry report. And just to give you a little bit of a snapshot, the sector here, as you probably all know, is extremely strong and growing. The employment from the clean energy has grown 84% since 2010. That's a pretty big number. Last year, we added 1,500 jobs, and that is despite a little downtick in our solar sector. And our clean energy gross state product grew 15%, representing $13.2 billion in Massachusetts. So I lead our offshore wind efforts, and really, quite simply, our role is to advance and support the responsible development of offshore wind. And we do that largely by working with the industry, working with stakeholders and others to identify risks, to identify barriers, to identify gaps, and work collaboratively to address those, and similarly to identify opportunities, partnerships, and work collaboratively to realize those. As Nate said, for the last 10 years, MassAEC has been helping lead the state effort, in particular in partnership with our federal partners at the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. So BOEM, out on the Outer Continental Shelf, is responsible for the siting and leasing of renewable energy. As BOEM has stood up their program from the 2005 Energy Policy Act, they really have genuinely looked to states to help shape that program and really sort of implement it. So, I think there's some fair amount of attention on the federal government right now, and rightfully so, and we can probably talk about that. I do think it is important to realize that they have established a program. It has come in fits and starts, But they've been very solid and capable leaders, and they have made an honest and genuine attempt to bring state and other partners and local partners into that mix. So that sort of pre-market work, as we call it, involves investing in marine wildlife studies, and we continue to do that with partners. We have endangered whales and birds present in the lease areas that Nate and other developers are working on. And so the responsible development aspect involves us understanding the spatial and temporal distribution of those animals. So that's really important information. So that would be called a gap, and we've worked to help fill that. We've also likewise invested in transmission studies. We help lead stakeholder engagement with habitat working groups, fisheries working groups. I can't tell you the number of community meetings we've had in this very building over the past 10 years on offshore wind. And nearly all that sort of led to, we've had some auctions, federal auctions for the leaseholders, but for Massachusetts, really sort of the leadership, and you heard this morning from our delegation at the table, in 2016, when the legislature passed and the governor signed the Energy Diversity Act, which required the state to go out with procurements for our utilities to procure cost-effective offshore wind. So that's 2016. So at MassEEC, you know, sort of seeing that sort of take hold, realizing that there's now an offtake and there really is now an industry, we started focusing in on sector development. So workforce, supply chain, ports and infrastructure. And we've been focusing a lot of our efforts on that over the past several years. So I won't, you know, go on more. I could, obviously, but I won't. I'll pass it back to Senator Wolf and let him take it from here.
Great. Yeah, Massachusetts really has emerged over the last decade as a visionary leader in this. And Bruce, I want to thank you very much for your work there. Amber Hewitt, who is the National Wildlife Federation's Offshore Wind Energy Campaign Manager, could you speak for a little bit about the offshore issues as it relates to wildlife?
Yes, of course. Thank you, and thanks, everyone. So I manage the National Wildlife Federation's campaign for offshore wind energy. The National Wildlife Federation started our offshore wind campaign in 2010 when we really, as an organization, we're stepping back in each of our regions. We're a national organization, and trying to determine what were some utility-scale clean energy solutions that we could really get excited about and really put more of our resources and time into. And at that time, offshore wind, for those of us looking at this in the Northeast region, offshore wind really jumped off the page as something that we as a wildlife organization concerned about climate change, recognizing climate change as the single greatest threat to wildlife and habitat. Offshore wind was something that we could really feel good about supporting in this region as a potentially transformative clean energy solution. Of course, as a wildlife organization, we had concerns with advocating for large-scale development in a vulnerable environment, and which really that's part of what drove us into building this campaign into the scale that we've built it to, and that is that we need to advance large-scale clean energy solutions. We don't believe that we have to, in addressing the climate crisis, do things that will worsen the parallel crisis of species decline and extinction. We try to find things that we believe can actually solve both of those crises at once, and offshore wind, if done right, we believe can be one of those solutions. So it's something we've been really excited about for about a decade. I do work nationally, though. I'm based in Newburyport, Massachusetts, which is my hometown, and I have been thrilled for all of this time that I've been working on offshore wind to really see Massachusetts leading the way. Both with the first procurement policy, but then also with the project really leading the nation. So I'll talk a bit both about why we are excited about offshore wind generally, but also why we're excited about the Vineyard Wind project in particular. So as I mentioned, our support is it's conditional. We have not supported every offshore wind project that has moved forward. We were thrilled to see the Block Island Wind Project, the Block Island Wind Farm, come to life, and that is one that we feel was built responsibly. We did litigate a project last year in New Jersey that we didn't feel was meeting our high standards of wildlife protection. So this really is something that we take seriously. Bruce mentioned endangered whales, and they really are our most significant concern offshore. But because of the limited time, I'll focus there, but would be happy to talk with all of you at length about birds and turtles and fish. This is there's extensive challenges offshore. But there are endangered whales that navigate all along, that migrate up and down the Atlantic coast, and they do pass through the areas designated for wind energy development. So we need to figure out how to handle that challenge while allowing offshore wind to move forward swiftly, because we are racing the clock of climate change. And that really comes down to doing things right, doing things at things like pile driving, loud construction activity at the time of year that we know whales are least likely to be in the area. That said, whales can travel off schedule, so we also need to be watching for them and listening for them at all times so that developers can cease activities. When a whale does pass through the area, we need to use advanced technology that can help to absorb some of the sound coming off of that activity. We need to reduce vessel speeds in the area. All of these things we believe are doable. That, of course, in the eye of a wildlife organization, is a bit easier to say than if you're talking to a developer who has a lot of money on the line and is trying to do this work as quickly as possible. So there are a couple pathways to how we get to this place of agreement on responsible development, and it can come by way of the law. So that a state can require that when we are passing these offshore wind procurement policies, a state can require that best management practices are in place throughout all stages of development. That kind of language is language that we as a conservation organization love, because best management practices then can evolve and adapt as we have more information. For example, the studies that Bruce mentioned have been immensely helpful in informing exactly what needs to be done to protect wildlife, particularly as climate changes the behavior and presence of wildlife, so we need to be able to adapt with that as we go. But in the absence of regulation requiring the protection of wildlife, we then go to the developer and ask them to work with us voluntarily and agree to these measures so that we can then be advocates for their project. So in the case of Vineyard Wind, in the case of and Black Island Wind Farm as well, but when we're talking large scale, with the project furthest out front, we were able to reach, and when I say we, I mean the National Wildlife Federation, the Conservation Law Foundation, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, our close partners in this work, were able to reach agreement on a set of protective measures to ensure that the right whale will be protected throughout all stages of development, which gives us everything we need to hear to be able to go to bat when these projects are meeting challenges out in the community, and to be able to speak up on behalf of their importance of and their adherence to the practices that we believe are important. And finally, I'll just say, while this is important to us on behalf of wildlife, it also is just important when we're talking about choosing successful projects, advancing successful projects, because while endangered whales are important to us, they're also very legally protected. So not adhering to these protective measures, putting these whales at risk, does also invite challenge from people, whether or not they really are concerned about endangered wildlife, that tools are in place to block a project. So it is something we also believe is just an important part of the recipe for success.
Thank you. And I guess, the short version of the question I would ask is, it sounds like in collaboration with other environmental wildlife organizations, it's sort of the gold standard seal of approval for this project. And it seems pretty universal, correct?
Yes. Yeah. I would say the short answer is yes. And then that there are just many. So as an example, Connecticut actually just passed an offshore wind policy that includes this language requiring projects to demonstrate adherence to best management practices. That's truly a gold standard, because then we don't need to depend on a developer. I mean, fortunately, Vineyard Wind was willing to meet us in that negotiation, but perhaps every developer won't be. So I would say gold standard.
That's fantastic. I want to introduce Eric Stelzer, who is the Director of the Renewables and Alternative Energy Division at the Massachusetts Department of Energy and Energy Resources, to talk a little bit about the state's role and the perspective.
Great, procurement. Thanks so much. It's great to talk about offshore wind on a windy day, so good to be here. We do a lot at Department of Energy Resources right now, whether we're looking at solar and smart tariff programs, whether we're looking at renewable portfolio standards and what we can do there, clean peak standard we're looking at and how we can further energy storage. So it's a busy time for us, nonetheless. But I'm here today to talk a little bit about offshore wind and what we're seeing. And I thought I'd just start by framing it and ask, you know, why offshore wind and what is it for Massachusetts and where it's at, and what are some of those drivers that are there that has gotten us to the point where we're at today. You know, certainly from a policy perspective, first and foremost, as Han was speaking earlier today, was the Global Warming Solutions Act, which is requiring us to have 25% GHG reductions by 2020. And as she mentioned earlier, you know, we're looking to at least have 80% GHG reductions by 2050. We've made significant progress in our electric sector in reducing those greenhouse gas emissions, but this is across all sectors. And so we're really looking at, you know, there's huge opportunity, and Nate really nailed that one down as far as the scale that offshore wind has to really significantly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions for the Commonwealth here. We're also very interested in making sure that energy is clean and diversifying our resources to provide us that resiliency that we need to ensure that folks can turn the electricity in their houses and the lights on when they need it. Another dynamic that's actively happening here is the retirement of the generation units. We don't have to look very far here on Cape Cod to see Pilgrim and, you know, how that's shutting down. And that's a lot of arguably clean energy that's needing to be replaced by some manner. And what is the role that offshore wind can play in helping to offset those generation retirements? Here, as was mentioned as well, we have a wind resource that arguably is better than some areas, a lot of areas that are in Europe that have these offshore wind resources already. And so we have that high-quality indigenous resource that is here for us to utilize. We have a lot of electricity load. We're talking a lot about electrification and what we can do about that as well. Our load's just going to continue to grow. As we continue to have more electric vehicles and more renewable thermal, like air source heat pump and ground source heat pump technologies, and that electricity is going to need to come from somewhere. We want to make sure that that's coming clean. And then certainly there's economic components that Bruce has talked about, establishing what we feel is a very competitive market up here. And it's a market that has evolved dramatically from the 2016 days when the legislation was initially passed for the Commonwealth to solicit for offshore wind. You know, at that time, Massachusetts was largely the player. We had Rhode Island, certainly, with the Block Island Wind Project, but there wasn't talk in Virginia about offshore wind. There wasn't talk in New Jersey about offshore wind. The dynamic over the last 3 years has really changed quite a bit. Next slide. So I thought with that context about framing offshore wind and why we're kind of here and why we're talking about this technology, I thought I'd just give you a quick update about, you know, where we're at in the process of procuring these offshore wind resources. First, you know, the legislation has been talked about, was passed in 2016, that requires us to go out and solicit to make sure that there's cost-effective resources that we can get. And through that process in 2017 and 2018, very competitive process by developers. They all gave great pricing on it, and Vineyard Wind came out on top with a real levelized price of 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour. That's phenomenal. We need to put that into perspective. So in our estimates of how that pricing is going to escalate and how electricity costs are going to escalate over that 20-year contract period of time, we found that there's going to be savings by going with offshore wind and by going with the Vineyard Wind proposal, in essence, helping to hedge ratepayers about the future escalation of cost to electricity. So that's really critical piece and the benefit that's happening too. Rhode Island also, as part of that process, secured 400 megawatts through our partnership. Next slide. Now we're currently in the process for the second solicitation that was issued out back in May. Bids were due more than a week ago, 6-8 weeks ago, back in August timeframe, and they're currently being reviewed. We are looking for proposals from 200 to 800 megawatts. Just one update on the slide. The slide is a little dated and from previous, and it mentions that there's a requirement that the pricing had to be lower. There was legislation that was subsequently passed this summer, which gave basically took off the price cap for this solicitation in particular. So just one correction there. But out of this process, we saw further competition through the three developers, Bay State Wind, Mayflower Wind, and Vineyard Wind, submitting proposals to us, and we're on target to make a selection on those by November 8th. Next slide. And then, so that's where we're at now, but we're also really looking at the future. You know, this isn't a one-and-done thing that we're looking at for offshore wind, but it's really looking at the technology and what we can do to continue with it. And legislation that was passed last year required the Department of Energy Resources to undertake an offshore wind study to assess whether we should continue with and whether DOER should authorize an additional 1,600 megawatts of offshore wind. And through this process, which was a lot of engagement with the public, asking questions, having one-on-one meetings with them, we ultimately decided that, you know, there was a potential for really significant benefits to ratepayers, and so we authorized an additional 1,600 megawatts. That's 1,600 megawatts on top of the already 1,600 megawatts, so a total of 3,200 megawatts, which is 30% of the load, the electric load, the current electric load here in Massachusetts could come from offshore wind. And some of the other key findings that this study highlighted as well is the real need, and this is something we were hearing loud and clear from stakeholders, is the need to have this staggered procurement in a predictable time frame, and that having that in that fashion could really help us to understand offshore wind better and do some of the monitoring and evaluation of this to help to assess further how we can minimize these environmental impacts, but at the same time provide that confidence to the market that they need to set up shop here and continue with economic development. Next slide. And then there's just a few other ones. I don't want to belabor it too much. That offshore wind study is out there in the public, but you know we also brought up areas of transmission. Where is this electricity going to be coming online? What can we do as far as planning it to provide the best benefits to ratepayers? We also found that economic development shouldn't solely be looked at just from the developers through these procurements, which are paid for through ratepayers. But what else can we do outside of these procurements to incentivize economic development and build that? So that's something we're certainly looking at further. And then certainly I talked a little bit about the environmental and evaluations and the staggered procurement side of things too. So hopefully that wasn't too long, but that's where we're at from a Commonwealth perspective.
What a fantastic summary. Thank you. Thank you, Eric. And then sort of to wrap up our introductions, I want to lateral over to Captain Michael Burns, who is at the Mass Maritime, to talk a little bit about the jobs aspect and the training aspect of this.
Sure. Thank you, everyone, for having me. So my name is Mike Burns. I'm the director of the Academy Center for Maritime and Professional Training, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our efforts to bring online an entry-level workforce training program using European standards developed by the Global Wind Organization. Next slide, please. A little bit about Mass Maritime. We've founded in 1891, recently ranked third best public college for return on investment by CNBC. Three graduate degree programs, about 1,400 cadets in our undergraduate programs, and all of those seven undergraduate programs in some way or another do touch this offshore wind industry in one way or another. Getting down to my level and what I do at the Academy, we also run a whole series of professional development programs. Most of those are for mariners, but when we were looking for our entry point into the offshore wind industry and how we might be able to contribute, we learned about the Global Wind Organization. And our feeling is that, you know, we've been training people to work at sea for 128 years. This is a new facet of that working at sea, and we feel like we've got something to offer there. We've got strong engineering programs. If we could go back to the last slide, please. Strong engineering programs, nautical science programs, and really a lot of the skills that we're training for in the GWO program are capabilities that we already have and that we're currently offering just under a different umbrella. So we're excited to be able to be a part of this and kind of help the workforce develop as this industry grows. Next slide, please. So a little bit about GWO. The Global Wind Organization is an industry consortium of different stakeholders, both developers, turbine manufacturers, large training providers, who meet on a regular basis and was founded in Europe to kind of develop a set of best practices based on constant feedback and evaluation from this organization. And they've developed a set of training standards that are globally recognized and recognized by all of these developers. So if you take a GWO course in the UK, it's recognized in France or the United States or anywhere else in the world. The GWO has also been gaining popularity in the U.S. They've recently developed a U.S. committee that's finishing up its meeting right now in upstate New York. And I think that really kind of shows the buy-in from a lot of the players that are involved in the U.S. side of offshore wind, that they believe that these standards are a good starting point and should be embraced here as well as in Europe. Next slide, please. Okay, for some reason something happened with the table there. At any rate, I'm going to talk about what Mass Maritime's jumping into initially in terms of GWO courses. And what we're focusing on is basic safety training for the offshore wind industry. And it's composed of five different modules, and all of them are required for pretty much anyone who's going to set foot on an offshore wind turbine, whether it's a technician or somebody involved in the construction, or anybody going out there for any reason. And it really does just cover basic things such as first aid, fire awareness, manual handling, working at heights, of course, and sea survival. And when we looked at what was actually taking place in each one of those modules, with the exception of working at heights, we were kind of doing it in one form or another. And so that it seemed like a good place for us to jump in. Sea survival is obviously one of the things that we concentrate on, and currently we're positioned to be the first training provider in the country that will be offering that GWO sea survival portion, and one of only a handful in the country that's offering basic safety as well. You can see there some of the topics that we cover in the sea survival course are just the same, just the things you might think of. How to deal with the elements, exposure to the elements, how to properly use life-saving appliances like life jackets, survival suits, and life rafts. We're obviously going to talk about how to transfer safely from the vessel up onto the tower, and you'll see a picture of that just to the right with a vessel approaching the turbine and crew transferring from the vessel up onto the tower. And safely transfer in their gear as well. We'll talk about man overboard, search and rescue. And the nice thing about the GWO program is there's not a whole lot of lecture involved. It's about 80% practical and 20% classroom. So there really is a lot of hands-on that goes with this training. So sea survival is a big focus of ours in this particular component. Next slide, please. Because of all of that practical level of training, there's a lot of equipment that goes with it and a lot of infrastructure to have to construct, especially where it just doesn't exist yet in the U.S. So with a tremendous amount of support from the Clean Energy Center, we've been able to develop what we're calling our crew transfer training facility, which is up on the left side there. And that is a tower that is simulating that transition piece from the water up onto the wind turbine generator. We'll have a vessel that's configured to conduct that safe transfer, and we can do it in a reasonably controlled environment, you know, just off our dock at the Academy. Along with that, we needed a place to put that tower, and under the facilities there, you'll see our smaller training vessel Ranger made up to the dock, and that last section of dock was also built with the support of the Mass Clean Energy Center so that we would have that extra extension to be able to build this facility to conduct our offshore sea survival portion of the training. Over on the right, we've also developed a working at heights, a climbing facility, which consists of three ladders, all of which might typically be found on the inside of a wind turbine, so the trainees can familiarize themselves with different type of fall protection, how to safely conduct an escape from a nacelle, and how to rescue a coworker if they become injured or if they fall. So with all of that strategic investment, we needed to invest in some strategic partnerships as well. Next slide. So while we do have the capabilities to conduct a lot of this training already, we needed that offshore wind expertise brought into it as well, particularly with the working at heights. So we had through a competitive bidding process, are partnering with a company called Rely on Newtek, which formerly was known as Falck Safety Services, and they are the largest provider of GWO training in the world, a globally recognized company, which brings a tremendous amount of expertise. They'll be helping us to train our instructors and providing some subject matter expertise and a GWO-approved curriculum for us to work with as well. Next slide. The last one I wanted to show you is the number of GWO training certificates. In other words, the number of people globally who currently hold certification of GWO training. And just to show you how really globally recognized it is, in the fourth quarter of 2016, there was about 5,000 people who had credentials with GWO. That has grown tremendously since then. And in 2019, that number is up to almost 80,000. So it is growing very rapidly along and keeping pace with the growth of the offshore wind industry in general, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. And we're looking forward to being involved in that and looking at training our instructors beginning of November and hopefully having classes up and running by the end of the year. And the last slide is just a question slide. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Captain. So you've heard from everybody on the panel now, and you know, I'll speak for myself. I wish I was 40 years younger and could start off going to the academy and getting trained and then jump right in with both feet into this industry. I will say that we sit in a perfect place, right? We've got the resource in the wind. We've got a willing and able and obviously responsible investment group that has come together to do this. We have a state procurement process. We have a federal process to lease the area. We have wildlife folks and environmentalists looking at it. This is a perfect arena and a perfect opportunity. I will say that 16 years ago, when I was teed up to be the next chair of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, remember this, Wendy? And the Cape Wind Project had been proposed for Nantucket Sound. I felt like it was a responsible thing to do and a good father thing to do. So I took my then 14-year-old daughter and the two of us went over to Denmark, and we went to Blåvands. It was November, so it wasn't a vacation because it actually reminded me of Cape Cod in November. But we took a look at what was then the largest offshore wind project in the world. There were 80 wind towers, and I think at that point a big tower was 3 megawatts. And I think we toured the site, we looked at it from shore, we went and met with the local Chamber of Commerce to talk about was there an impact on business. We talked to environmentalists there, and probably the coolest part for me as an aircraft mechanic was to go to the Vestas plant, and we got a full tour, day tour of the plant. And for me it was like Lilliput, or it was like, remember that movie where they injected the little miniature people into the, because as an airplane guy, I felt like I was walking around on the inside of an airplane engine. When you look at the technology, it's just incredible. And you see the size and scope. And that was 3 megawatt towers as opposed to this. But I did my due diligence and came back and never really decided on the Cape Wind thing. The people who were against it tried to tell people I was in favor of it. The people who were in favor of it tried to tell people I was against it. And the reality was, just like a lot of people in here, I was hopelessly conflicted because it was a bad business model and it was definitely a private grab of public resource. On the other hand, for those of us who believed in climate change in 2004,
it was also an opportunity to take that first step. So we were wrapped in a pretzel around it. Now you fast forward 16 years, and we've done it all right. I will say that back in 2004 when I was in Denmark, I never would have thought that we'd be here 16 years later, and still the United States would not have a so-called industrial-scale offshore wind project. But we are right on the doorstep of that. This is leading up to a question, so you all got to stay with me because I'm going to actually ask a question when I'm done giving my monologue here. It's great being the moderator of these things because only a couple people can give you the hook, right? But I guess the question is, you know, how is that possible that 16 years later we still seem stalled or a little bit wrapped around the axle on this? So I want to start with Nate down the other end, and I want to hear, first of all, what your perspective is on why this is taking so long, a little bit of where we are today and what the current obstacles are, but most importantly, because a lot of hands went up when I said who supports this, what the people in this room can do to actually get this thing to completion. And I also want you to address any fears we might have that if we hit the end of 2019 and this still isn't a point of indecision, does that mean Vineyard Wind is done or dead, or where do we stand in the process? So go ahead. The obstacles, why, and then what we can do going forward.
May I take the third part last?
Sure.
There in any of these developments, there are setbacks, and there are ones that are more challenging than others. And it is not a matter of if, but when. And we're looking now to early 2020 for the final federal decision, and we're working with people at the federal level on that, and there's a lot of the confluence of interests that came out of the woodwork it appeared that this industry, and we're at the knife's edge of it, was potentially going to hit another speed bump, was really incredible. I just had a moment talking to Senator Markey about the fact that he joined with members of the Louisiana delegation to support the efficient and timely permitting of offshore wind. And you may ask, when does Louisiana and Massachusetts agree on anything? The economic fundamentals have turned on their head, and if anyone is explaining bad economics to you on offshore wind, they're probably using very old, antiquated talking points. Maybe those ones that were spoken to us in 2003, which may have been a little bit more real. This is an evolved industry. There are 100 offshore wind facilities operating at commercial scale in Europe. 4,000 turbines are spinning. It's a decades-old industry. There's not a lot of mystery here. One of the things that we see, you know, in the landscape now, why it's taken so long, there was a policy vacuum. I have to, full disclosure, admit that I've been working in state and federal politics in the early 2000s as a child, I guess, I was against the Cape Wind project for some of the fundamentals that project proposed, and again, conflicted at how do we pursue this. It's taken a long time to set the framework up. It's taken a long time to develop a consensus that is broad and deep here and increasingly at a national level about wind. Go to Iowa and ask if wind is an issue. Go to Colorado, where they do the manufacturing. You're seeing the Carolinas, and you're seeing a major national set of initiatives spurred by Massachusetts as the leader to ground this industry here, but to be only one of many, many states that's going to pursue this. So remind me of previous
questions. What can the people in this room do?
Well, it's important to know that the permitting, the regulatory, the policy matrix, the things that that our representatives at the state and federal level are pushing are important initiatives to get behind. Only of the 30-plus agencies that we have to deal with and get sign-offs and permits and reviews from, only some of those are at the federal level, but I'd say probably roughly half. At the state level, you've got major threads of environmental and energy siting permitting. At the regional level, we've got a regulatory planning agency in the Cape Cod Commission, as well as the Martha's Vineyard Commission on the vineyard. You've got local authorities. We went before three conservation commissions, went two for three, and received our only initial pushback from a local regulator in Edgartown, and we're able to resolve those issues through an agreement with some enhanced monitoring and a little bit more conversation. Each of those places is an opportunity for advocacy. It's an opportunity not just to say we support this, we're concerned about climate change, we support the project, but to engage in a meaningful dialogue. It gets more complex than that. It requires being a voice and devoting a little bit of time amongst your neighbors, amongst your friends who may be in other towns. Our time is divided, but devoting time to that. I don't know if Andy Gottlieb's in the room, but he's had this statement where if you show up with three people to a public meeting, it makes people listen, and you show up with a dozen, it becomes a revolution. The impact. There's areas of stage here. The impact in your hometown that you can have on local politics and local issues, be they climate related, offshore wind related, development related, whatever, is huge. And I want to add to that in this room, the impact that an area like Cape Cod, if we're able to regionally attack these things and come up with solutions at our regional level, both embracing the big projects, embracing the municipal level and neighborhood level projects, it's something really special. We're all looking around. The concern and the fear is that of offshore wind, the only one is it's new to us, right? Should I buy an EV? I don't know. It's new to me. But if your neighbor has one, that will help. If we can provide these solutions at a regional level, and if we can affirmatively embrace after many years of contention something like offshore wind and be vocal about it to in the public sphere, in the private sphere, at your kitchen table with your friends, it's something that can have a huge amount of impact. We feel small when we approach the climate issue, but know that engaging in this meaningful dialogue, spreading real information, and talking with your friends can be extremely valuable.
Thank you.
There are a number of formal times when you can communicate with regulators and legislators and the type, and we encourage you to keep an eye out for those because they need more voices.
Thank you. Captain, do you have any thoughts?
I think it was pretty well covered, actually.
Great. Yeah. Amber?
Yeah, Nate said so much of what was on my mind, so I will just add that this is, as an environmentalist and a millennial, I believe that this hasn't happened because it's a disruptive industry. It's something that is going to replace power plants. So the scale of that is intimidating to powerful entities that don't want it to happen. So I do believe it is a matter of rising to the scale of that challenge. We're talking about fossil fuel and commercial fishing entities. Those are very well funded, very well organized, and so the scale of the challenge really does demand, as Nate was saying, resounding support to really create the political will that we need to make this happen.
Great, thank you. Bruce?
I don't have a lot to add. Nate did an excellent job, and Amber echoed some key points. Change is hard, and I think that folks just got to sort of keep their head down. I think the preface that you set, going from the Cape Wind to where we are now, we're in a different universe, okay? So I think, I just one of the takeaways here is sort of Cape Wind was an unsolicited effort that essentially had public policy, governments, energy markets, financiers, and others kind of chasing after it a little bit, and everybody's sort of back on their heels. The industry that we're talking about now, as I mentioned, we started 10 years ago, and that was after preliminary work. That's the process we started 10 years ago to get to where we are now. As I mentioned before, I have literally been in this building probably 20 times talking about the process, talking about Vineyard Wind. It's been iterative. And I guess I'd last say is, let's not be like have the perfect what is the word I'm looking for? There you go. Thank you very much. Turnout, we're going to get there. There's going to be a significant amount of local economic workforce benefits on top of the mandatory climate greenhouse gas reduction. We can't meet any of the goals that you guys are all here about today. We cannot do it without offshore wind.
Great. Eric?
Just a few thoughts. Siting any energy infrastructure in New England is difficult. Whether you're an offshore wind facility, whether you're a wind turbine in Falmouth, whether you're a solar facility that's cutting down trees, or whether you're a biomass plant that's in Springfield, it's difficult. And I think it's really important through this process that it's a collaborative, it's a stakeholder engagement process. I think part of that is not so much just sharing your voice and the importance to that, but it's also listening. And it's also because these issues that folks are bringing up are really vested. They have a lot of vested interest. And so I think it's a process that takes time, but it takes time so that the end product is all better. There's a lot more buy-in to it. And at the end of the day, then it'll be much more successful.
Great. I promised that I wouldn't be political, but I know that there are a lot of people who are wondering the following question, and there's a very short answer that I would like to hear. And if you feel like, if you want to pass on it, pass on it. But I think this is going to go to how much we care and how active we are in the next year politically. And I guess my question is, if you believe that the current administration, and I won't use names, is blocking this now, can this project get done with this administration? Can it, is it possible, or are we going to have to wait for a sea change? Nate?
I would jump into this and say that I think this project can and will get done, irrespective of the administration. I will say that doesn't come with a lot of hard work that has already been done and will continue to do. But as I think Rep. Fernandez had mentioned, the Interior was ushering this along and following that lead, and it was a productive relationship. There are going to be hiccups with regulators. This is certainly one that caused a lot of raised eyebrows and disappointment. It doesn't mean that it doesn't by any means mean that there's this is the death knell of any kind. And again, there's so much energy in rooms like this that crosses partisan lines. There's so much energy nationwide that I think there's a lot of reason to be optimism. But it isn't going to come without hard work. It isn't going to come automatically. It was a little disturbing to hear even a year ago of folks kind of saying, well, this one looks like it's on its way, done deal. It's good. Nothing happens without a lot of effort by people like yourselves, by regulators committing themselves to working overtime to review this stuff, and by people stepping in from far afield to push it forward. So I'm optimistic. I wouldn't say that it's a showstopper that there's an administration that has had some skepticism about renewables for us.
That's very positive. Thanks. Yeah, Bruce, do you have a thought on that?
Yes, I do. And I'd like to sort of echo what Nate says. And I guess I would take a sort of a slightly different position, and that's that I hope that people actually don't make this a political issue. So the U.S. is now one of the global leaders in onshore wind. And that includes blue states and red states.
Texas.
Yep. So there are plenty of our states out in the Rocky Midwest and down south that are investing and reaping the benefits. Again, as I mentioned before, workforce, economic development, tax credits for farmers, on down the line, manufacturing facilities established here in the U.S. And we can't make this a political issue. Yes, there are fights ahead, and yes, it's a distraction down there. I honestly think, the secretary took a hard look at what was before him and what, as Eric's point, what's happened since 2017 in terms of state now sort of commitments to offshore wind. And I think just sort of said, hey, I feel more comfortable pausing and making sure that I've got my I's dotted and my T's crossed. So I'm still optimistic. I think that starts to backfire if it becomes a huge big thing to focus on and becomes highly and overly politicized.
Great. Thank you. Captain, do you have a thought?
I would just say, having attended quite a few industry conferences and meetings, the level of interest not only from the developers, but from the states all up and down the East Coast. The momentum that's happening right now is tremendous, and I definitely see that this will happen.
Great. Amber?
Yeah, I do. I share everyone's optimism that this will happen regardless, but I will also say this isn't something that we should be fighting politicians on. This is something that we should have allies on. So while I believe that we'll get this done either way, please vote.
Great. Yeah. Eric, do you have a thought on
this? Yeah, I certainly we're optimistic. we're going to see this all the way to the end, you know, and everyone in the Commonwealth is working towards what we can do to have this project be accomplished. So certainly holding on to the optimism there.
Great. I mean, and I would just, you know, because you asked my opinion, this is so good on so many levels, so that whether you're looking at it from an environmental level or a jobs level or an economic development level or, you know, a predictability of business model, because we're able to run these numbers out a long time, so it reduces volatility from the energy market. There are just so many reasons why I agree this can't and shouldn't be politicized. So, and the reason, and I was actually asked to ask that question. This does not come from your former senator. That was a question that was teed up in the questions that I was supposed to ask. So don't think it came from me. But I'm actually really encouraged that this panel understands it's not a political issue. It's an environmental issue. It's a business issue. It's a lot of different issues. One last question as the clock runs out, because I think the people in here are sophisticated enough to understand it. But we have a real motive force to building solar, to doing distributive, sustainable energy production, whether it's solar or small-scale wind or small-scale hydro or geothermal. There's just a ton of really exciting stuff in our backyard. And then Nate starts off the presentation by saying, by the way, our project over there is going to be 2x what the Cape needs. So why should we do any of the other stuff?
Well I guess I'll start with that. It's electricity. It's just electricity. There's three other really important sectors that are here. We have transportation. We had some great discussions about that earlier. We have our building space that we're needing to do. And at DOER, we're looking at renewable thermal technologies and what we can do to further increase the adoption rate of those technologies. Because if we only focus on the electricity sector, where we have had some significant gains on GHG reductions, but if we only focus on that, we're not going to even come close to meeting our goals. You know, Han earlier was talking about land use and how land use is going to be important for us to reach net zero. It's at that type of level and at that type of holistic thinking that needs to happen. So,
any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree. So, our load, our electric load is only going to, we're going to continue to be energy efficient. We were just named again for the 9th or 10th year in a row the most energy efficient state in the nation. Thank you all, because you all helped do that. But as we move to the necessary electrification of our transportation and thermal sectors, our load's going to increase. And so our electric generation needs to be diversified, it needs to be redundant, and it needs to be resilient. So that means multiple sources. And as you heard before, with smarter grids, storage, and increasing innovation in technology and usage.
Yeah, and in closing, I mean, it was sort of a leading the witness question. The reality is, and this is what you talk to your neighbors about, we should be doing the distributive small scale, because anytime we produce here and use locally, we're spilling more of that project across the bridge and out to the rest of the Commonwealth. So what we want to do is be able to not only claim that we're net zero, we want to claim eventually that we are a net exporter of sustainable electricity. What a great goal that would be, that we will be seen as the distributive center of everything that is good and sustainable. I want to thank the panel. This was fun and engaging, and thank you all. And on we go.
Thank you all. Thank you, Dan. Before we set you to go off on a task, and instead of listening and receiving, we're going to ask you to